The Oracle Network. Hey friends, welcome back to the show. I'm your host Melanie Peterson, and I have quite the bizarre case for you today. I am currently working on a new Beyond the Mask episode for you, but it's taking some time and I didn't want you to not have something to listen to this week, so I'm releasing one of my bonus Patreon episodes from last year. In 1969, police were searching for Patricia Walsh and Marianne Misaki, who had both gone missing around January 24th from Provincetown, Massachusetts, while they were there on a visit. As the police decided to extend the search area into the old Truro Cemetery, they uncovered the mutilated remains of Susan Perry on February 8th. Perry had been missing since the previous September, and just a month after her body was found, police found the partial remains of Marianne Misaki. And with this discovery, they were beginning to fear that there was possibly some unknown killer running around loose in this quiet town on the Cape. As the investigation continued, the deceased bodies of Patricia Walsh and Sidney Monson were found along with the rest of Marianne's remains not far from where Susan Perry's remains had been found. The bodies were discovered in a forest clearing near a makeshift marijuana garden. Each of the bodies had been stabbed and mutilated. Some were riddled with teeth marks, and the coroner also found evidence of necrophilia. When Anton Costa was discovered to be driving Patricia Walsh's Volkswagen, police questioned him. But the 24-year-old Costa claimed he had purchased the vehicle before the two women went to Canada, and while this was suspicious, there wasn't enough to hold him just yet. That is, until police learned whose garden it was. Anton Costa would be arrested and charged with murder, and the revelation that followed is something that has haunted this quiet Cape Cod town for nearly 50 years. Buckle up, my friends. This one is going to be a bumpy ride. This is Mask of Sanity. Anton Charles Costa, who went by the nickname Tony, was born on August 2, 1944 in Provincetown, Massachusetts, to Cecilia and his father Anton Costa. His father was away serving as a ship's mate in the United States Navy and unfortunately died during World War II shortly after his birth. Growing up without a father had a significant impact on Costa, and when he was seven, he told his mother that he was being awakened at night by a man entering his room. There was never any evidence of a break-in, and this man was never seen by anyone else. It wasn't until Costa saw a picture of his deceased father that he was able to identify the man he claimed kept entering his room each night. Did Costa actually see the ghost of his father? Or was he imagining it, his subconscious trying to connect him with a father he never knew? Not much is really known about Costa's childhood, but one can speculate that it wasn't all rainbows and sunshine. He never met his father, and his mother may have remarried, but there's no evidence to suggest that. This time in U.S. history was a struggle for many, many families, and Costa seemed to have a tough time adjusting. Classmates remember him as being kind of a loner, quiet, maybe a little strange. But in November 1961, when he was 17 years old, Costa, quote, snuck into an apartment in Somerville, Massachusetts, and bent over a bed of a teenage girl, end quote. He watched her as she slept until she woke up, screaming at the sight of the unwelcome guest in her bedroom, and causing Costa to flee. You would think that he would have learned his lesson or been deterred by the fact that this girl woke up screaming, and he was lucky he wasn't caught the first time, but no. Costa returned to the girl's house just 3 days later and tried to kidnap her, dragging her down the stairs of her apartment building, and thankfully neighbors heard her screaming and intervened. Thankfully, this time, because of that, he was caught and he was convicted of burglary and assault on January 4th, 1962. However, the punishment was severely lacking, possibly due to his age and the fact that he was technically a minor at 17. So he only received a 1-year suspended sentence and 3 years probation. Just a year later, Costa got married to a 14-year-old girl, and over the next 3 years, they had 3 children. During this time, Costa also began using drugs pretty consistently, which led to a lot of marital problems, as well as, quote, bizarre and irresponsible behavior, end quote. In June of 1966, Costa allegedly, quote, brought home 2 hippie girls, Bonnie Williams and Diane Fedoroff, with the announcement that he would be driving them to Pennsylvania, moving on alone from there to California. Later, Costa told police he drove the girls to Hayward, California, but they never got there. Costa surfaced at his home in Massachusetts 10 days later, end quote. Because of the timeline and the suspiciousness of his version of the story, Bonnie and Diane are believed to have been his first victims. Costa's behavior continued to push the boundaries of what society considered normal. The following August, he and a female acquaintance were enjoying the late summer weather on the Cape and decided to go for a hike in the Truro Woods. Without provocation, Costa claimed he accidentally shot his friend with an arrow. However, given what we know about him, it's pretty hard to believe that this was actually an accident. By January 1968, Costa's marriage was pretty much over because of his erratic behavior, so he decided to drive across the country and settle in San Francisco, specifically in the Haight Ashbury District, which was known as a free-spirited district home to the Flower Power movement. During his time in California, Costa met and began dating Barbara Spalding. Barbara and her child spent a lot of time with him. They were exploring the city, but after a few months, Barbara left her child with her family and told them she was heading to Massachusetts with Costa. However, this would be the last time anyone would ever see her alive. During the drive back east in the spring of 1968, Costa was pulled over for speeding and for having a noisy muffler by Officer Tom Gunnery of the Massachusetts State Police. Gunnery recalled that Costa seemed a bit off. He was acting suspiciously during the traffic stop, but at the time it wasn't really enough to warrant a search, and Officer Gunnery kind of just chalked this behavior up to being a bit nervous during the interaction. When Officer Gunnery, quote, later learned that Costa was seen with a girl 2 days before her disappearing, end quote, this made him very confident that the reason why Costa was acting strange was probably due to the fact that the girl, potentially Barbara Spalding, was in the trunk of his car during the stop. What he did with her body has never been determined, and sadly, her remains have never been found. Upon his return to Provincetown, Costa's behavior just continued to get more and more bizarre. On May 17, 1968, he stole nearly $5,000 worth of surgical equipment and prescription drugs from a doctor's office. Just a week later, on May 24th, 18-year-old Sydney Monson, an acquaintance of Costa's, went missing. She disappeared from her home, but it wouldn't actually be reported to police until June. During this time, Costa and his wife were in the process of divorcing, and it would finally be settled in August under the agreement that Costa would provide financial support for his wife and his 3 children. But he would be arrested just a few weeks later on September 25th because he had failed to come through on the alimony and child support. Shortly before his arrest, Costa's girlfriend of 1 week, Susan Perry, disappeared around September 10th. Costa told friends that she had left for Mexico, but according to her friends, it didn't make sense that she would just up and leave, especially without saying goodbye. Costa was also arrested in mid-September for driving with a suspended license, so he really is just batting 1,000 here, and would end up serving a little less than 2 months in jail, getting out on November 8th. By now, 24-year-old Costa was a full-blown drug addict and fully immersed into the hip scene, usually hanging out with Christine Gallant and doing drugs, but less than 2 weeks after Costa's release, Gallant was found dead from a barbiturate overdose in her bathtub. At the time, the coroner's report stated she had died from drowning when she fell unconscious from the drugs, but now it's suspected that Costa may have been involved with her death as well. Costa laid low over the holidays, but his days of flying below the radar of suspicion were severely numbered. In late January 1969, Patricia Walsh and Marianne Wasaki, both 23 years old, disappeared while visiting Provincetown. They had reserved a room in a guest house run by a Mrs. Morton for 2 nights, and Mrs. Morton is allegedly the one who introduced the women to Costa, who is also staying in the house. The day after their arrival, Mrs. Morton found a note on their door which asked, quote, "Could you possibly give me a ride to Truro early in the morning?" end quote. And the name at the bottom of the note was Tony, Costa's nickname. Patricia and Marianne agreed and were spotted the next day, January 25th, in Patricia's light blue Volkswagen with Costa in the passenger seat. They were driving up the street when Costa called out to a friend named Zacharias, who they were driving past. They stopped the car, and Costa and Zacharias had a short conversation, and he also handed Costa his check from the men's mutual boss. After saying their goodbyes, Zacharias recalled that the vehicle continued on towards Truro, but initial suspicions about their disappearance began when Patricia and Marianne missed an appointment in Provincetown later that day. In the early hours of their disappearance, there weren't any witnesses, anyone who was able to positively say they saw either Patricia or Marianne since the early afternoon on the 25th. Mrs. Morton found another note on their door the following morning after they failed to keep their appointment. The note stated, quote, "We are checking out. Thank you for your many kindnesses," end quote. However, what was suspicious about the note is that it was written on the exact same paper as the first note written by Costa. Mrs. Morton also recalled that she saw Costa at the house just a few hours after he had left with the women to go to Truro. Just a few days after the women were last seen, Costa drove Patricia's car to a gas station on Wednesday, January 29th, and inquired as to how much it would cost to paint the vehicle an exotic color. The following Sunday, now a week after they were last seen, a passerby saw the Volkswagen parked in a wooded area of Truro. This area was pretty isolated. There aren't many people out there, so seeing a strange car parked there definitely got this person's attention, and they contacted the police chief. Later that same day, Costa asked a couple friends to ride with him to Boston, but told them that they needed first to pick up the car. He told them, quote, he was sure it would start because he had been out there a week ago and it had started all right. Costa and his two friends went to the wooded area in Truro and from there drove to Boston in the Walsh Volkswagen. Costa told his two friends that two girls had given him the car and they were going to Canada, end quote. When Costa and his friends arrived in Boston, he immediately began asking around for anywhere that he could obtain a fake driver's license, registration, and a bill of sale for the car. And there's nothing suspicious about that at all, right? Costa continued to act strangely. He also tried to sell a .22 caliber pistol to two of his friends that he told them the gun was actually buried in the Truro woods. Why you would bury the gun you're trying to sell in the middle of the woods is beyond me. I don't understand that thought process at all. On February 7th, Costa decided to rent a parking spot for the Volkswagen and even tried to register the vehicle in his own name while he was in Vermont. Apparently, Costa wasn't smart enough to get rid of the vehicle's original Rhode Island license plate, which was discovered underneath the floor mat of the car. By this time, police were aware that both women were missing, and the following day, items belonging to Patricia and Marianne were found inside the room he rented from Mrs. Morton, which he had surreptitiously moved out of their room after he returned to the house the same day that they were murdered. Not long after this discovery, along with the eyewitness accounts of Costa's movements, police initiated a search of the wooded areas of Truro for Patricia Walsh and Marianne Wysocki, hoping that they weren't too late. As police looked for the women, they came across the mutilated body of another woman on February 8th. The remains, cut up in 8 separate pieces, were found partially buried in the old Truro cemetery and belonged to Susan Perry, Costa's girlfriend, who he claimed had gone to Mexico. With the discovery of Susan's remains, police began to focus their search around the cemetery and extended the search perimeter to include an extended radius of at least 2 miles. On March 3rd, quote, a telegram from New York City addressed to Costa arrived at his mother's home in Provincetown. It was signed Pat and Marianne. Costa's mother took it to the police. It was later shown that the telegram originated from a New York City telephone number to which Costa had access, end quote. The next day, March 4th, police made another grisly discovery, locating the remains of Patricia Walsh, Marianne Wysocki, and Sidney Monson, approximately 1.5 miles from where Susan Perry's body was found. Marianne's head and torso were in a hole, and notably located near a plot of land that had been used to grow marijuana. Not far from this hole, police found the rest of Marianne's remains, as well as the body of Patricia Walsh, and as they uncovered the remains, they found the dismembered body of Sidney Monson buried underneath Patricia. All 3 bodies had been mutilated with a knife, each sustaining multiple stab wounds to the chest wall and buttocks. Walsh had been shot in the neck, and Wysocki sustained 2 gunshot wounds, one to the left side of her head and one in the back of her head, execution style. They also found a .22 caliber pistol buried nearby. If you remember, that's the exact same caliber pistol that he was trying to sell to 2 of his friends, and he said that it was buried in the woods. Each body also had multiple bite marks, and after the autopsies had been completed, it was determined that each of the bodies had been sexually assaulted after they died. The 3 .22 shells found at the scene were tested and forensically determined to have been fired from the gun that they found. Additionally, they had conducted another search of Costa's rented room, which revealed a piece of rope, as well as a pair of his boots, both with bloodstains. With 4 murders uncovered in such a short period of time, police launched an investigation into the deaths and the person responsible, realizing that the murders were most likely the work of one person. During the early investigation, remember that police had, quote, learned that Walsh and Wysocki had met Anton Costa in Provincetown. Found in possession of their car, Costa produced a suspicious bill of sale claiming he purchased the vehicle before the women left for Canada, end quote. At the same time, police were attempting to question Costa and get his side of the story. They were doing this through phone calls and in-person interviews, and throughout all of this, Costa provided them with, quote, 3 mutually inconsistent versions concerning his last contact with the girls and the manner in which he came into possession of Miss Walsh's automobile, end quote. However, because the remains of Walsh and Wysocki had been found in a wooded area just outside of town, it was quite obvious that Costa wasn't telling the truth, but at the time, they didn't have anything definite. There was no key piece of evidence that linked him to the murders. Detectives would soon have more than enough information to arrest Costa when they were informed that the location where Walsh, Wysocki, and Monson were found was the same area that Costa unofficially used as a garden for growing marijuana and stashing other drugs, and the fact that he had a known, proven connection with each of the dead women. With this new information, Costa was arrested, and when questioned, he had a hard time keeping his story straight, again changing details, blaming others who had nothing to do with it, as well as failing multiple polygraph tests. The discovery of four murdered women rocked the small community of Provincetown, and it didn't help that details were blown out of proportion, perhaps a little falsified by District Attorney Edmund Dennis, whose comments at a press conference caused essentially a media frenzy. He was quoted as saying, quote, "The hearts of each girl had been removed from the bodies and were not in the graves, nor were they found. A razor-like device was found near the graves. Each body was cut into as many parts as there are joints," end quote. Also around this time, the media had latched onto the moniker the Cape Cod Vampire and asked Dennis at the press conference if the murders were the work of the Cape Cod Vampire, to which he said yes, and this further ignited the case into an international media sensation. Reporters gave Costa nicknames such as the Cape Cod Casanova and Chop Chop Tony. It's also reported that many of the details around the murders were untrue. And like I said, at the very least, extremely over-exaggerated. The initial claims confirmed by District Attorney Dennis that the hearts had been removed were later found to be false. Some organs were missing from one of the bodies, but the ritualistic shroud around the removal of the hearts was completely made up. It was completely fabricated. Costa went through several psychiatric examinations. The first one occurred on March 31st, in which the doctor diagnosed him with schizoid personality disorder. A person with a schizoid personality primarily lacks emotion and general concern for others. They can be fully functioning members of society, although they may be viewed as odd or eccentric, but in Costa's case, his lack of emotional expression and perhaps his drug use was in a search to feel something. He was using these drugs. He was going to this extreme of murdering people to possibly feel something. But at the end of the day, it didn't help. He felt completely indifferent and remorseless about what he had done. With this first diagnosis, the reasons behind Costa's decision to commit murder became clearer, but his second psychiatric evaluation, which took place in June, offered a more terrifying conclusion. This psychiatrist, quote, characterized Costa as a modern-day Marquis de Sade and a sexually dangerous man, end quote. This psychiatrist also believed that Costa was completely capable of murder. About a month after this evaluation, Costa would end up confessing to the murder of Marianne Wasacki on July 12, 1969, and by April 9, 1970, he would be indicted on all four murders. His trial was slated to begin on May 6, and his lawyers were using his drug abuse and his diagnosis of a schizoid personality as a defense to try to make the jury see him as insane, stating that Costa was under the influence of drugs and not in the right mind to understand the gravity of what he was doing. The pathologist took the stand and stated that, quote, the mutilation and dismemberment of the bodies were done after death, and that his findings were consistent with the psychiatric condition known as necrophilia, that is, the perverse sexual attraction to dead bodies. The pathologist further described the numerous stab wounds and slashing-type wounds, which he inferred from his findings, were all inflicted after death. In each case, there was evidence of sexual abuse, end quote. The defense team, led by Maurice M. Goldman, even brought in several medical professionals and psychiatrists to testify how the drugs would affect someone who used them as heavily as Costa, and that his mental capacity was severely diminished. Unfortunately, there were four psychiatrists that testified, and they had conflicting ideas about his mental health. Two psychiatrists testified that Costa suffered from borderline schizophrenia, and the other two stated that he only had a personality disorder. These testimonies, along with the defense's attempt to ensure a verdict of not guilty by reason of insanity, just didn't hold up enough with the jury, especially after Costa delivered a coherent and apparently very well thought out speech while on the stand. As a result, he was convicted of the murders of Patricia Walsh and Marianne Wysocki, receiving a life sentence on May 29th after it was decided that the death penalty would be ruled out. Life in prison revealed a strange side to Costa, and that's saying a lot because he was already a pretty weird dude and a murderer. He, quote, began stalking his cell with books on ritual magic and the occult, including a copy of Anton LaVey's Satanic Bible, end quote. He also wrote a book called Resurrection, in which he didn't exactly take responsibility for the murders. Instead, he blamed a man named Carl for shooting Marianne and Patricia, as well as claiming that Sydney and Susan both died from drug overdoses. Costa also claimed, quote, that after realizing that Wysocki was still alive, he decided to end her suffering with a knife, and that he and Carl buried the bodies, end quote. He also wrote that his knowledge that the murders had happened was his only involvement, but right there, he contradicts himself. He allegedly admitted to murdering Marianne Wysocki with the knife after this supposed Carl shot her to end her suffering, but then he's saying that his only involvement is the fact that he knew about the murders. So it's quite clear that Anton Costa was a very severely mentally ill person, didn't get the treatment he needed, didn't have the help or the sources or the resources, support, everything that he needed. And unfortunately, his drug abuse exacerbated this behavior as well. And it led to him ultimately murdering at least 4 women that they know of, and quite possibly more. Remember at the beginning of the episode, he brought home 2 women, Bonnie and Diane, and said that he was going to drive them to California, but they never made it to California, and it's very likely that he murdered them as well. After nearly 4 years behind bars, 29-year-old Anton Costa committed suicide on May 12, 1974, at Walpole Prison, hanging himself in his cell using his leather belt. More than 40 years after he took his own life, tourists still converge on Provincetown, walking through the Truro Woods, hoping to maybe discover something missed by police all those years ago in the cemetery, or have some sort of paranormal experience. They walk through his now overgrown garden, and if they're brave enough, they'll step inside the brick crypt where he supposedly dismembered his victims. I've seen pictures of it, and I don't know if I'd go in there at night. Being in a place where a murder has knowingly taken place just leaves a certain feel in the atmosphere to me. I don't fancy myself a psychic or anything like that. That's not what I'm saying. But I know that me personally, I can feel the difference in the air, basically, when I'm in an enclosed space where something tragic has taken place. And it reminds me a lot of how I felt when I was on vacation. I traveled to Germany back in 2008, and my friend and I went on a tour of the Sachsenhausen concentration camp that's just outside of Berlin. Part of the tour took us into one of the rooms where the Nazis stored the bodies after they murdered them in the gas chamber, and I'm pretty sure that I spent a whole 0.4 seconds down there because it just felt wrong. It was like I had goosebumps. It was cold. You could still see stains on the floor, and it was completely horrifying, and I just couldn't handle being down there. Others on the tour were taking pictures, and I just had to get out. The air felt heavier. It felt like I was trespassing. And I know some people might say, well, Mel, that's probably all in your head. And maybe so, but it doesn't change the way I felt and how I remember that experience now more than 10 years ago. And that's what I assume going inside that brick crypt would feel like.
The Truro Cemetery is pretty isolated, and others who have been there also describe it kind of giving off a vibe, almost like you can feel death. So I do believe that some people are feeling that, just like I did in Germany. Costa's infamy even got the attention of author Kurt Vonnegut, most popularly known for Slaughterhouse-Five, who, quote, compared Costa to Charles Manson in his collection of essays entitled Wampeters, Foma, and Grand Falloons, end quote, which was published in May 1974, which was right around the same time that Costa committed suicide. Vonnegut's niece, Edith, had apparently met Costa at one point as well, so I'm sure Vonnegut, his niece, were both breathing a huge sigh of relief because she pretty much sidestepped a major landmine there. Alright friends, that was Anton Costa, the Cape Cod Casanova. As always, a huge thank you to all of you who listen, especially you who are my Patreon supporters. You have no idea how grateful I am for you. I really appreciate you tuning in. I hope you're enjoying all of the regular episodes as well as all of the bonus episodes that I've done for you. And you can always reach out to Mask of Sanity on any of the social medias. My Instagram is Mask of Sanity the Podcast. Twitter is at Mask Sanity Pod. There's also the Facebook page, Mask of Sanity the Podcast. If you ever have suggestions, questions, feedback, whatever, my inboxes or my email, Mask of Sanity the Podcast, all one word, at gmail.com. Always open to you. Feel free to drop me a line.
If you want to let me and others know how much you enjoy the show, please consider leaving a 5-star review on whatever podcast player you listen. This helps me know what I'm doing well, what maybe I need to work on. I really appreciate any feedback and constructive criticism from my listeners that help make the show really just better for everyone. Please stick around after the episode for the Oracle Network's Podcast of the Month promo, True Crime Cat Lawyer, hosted by Elise and her furry co-host Winston. I love this show. I love the concept. It's so well done. And as we know, I love my kitties. So how could I pass up a show with a friend like Winston helping out? Check out their show wherever you listen. Head on over to the Oracle Network website and watch their Get to Know the Host video, and make sure to leave them a 5-star rating and review. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, stay safe, friends.
Hi there, my name's Elise and I am a lawyer in the Pacific Northwest. I host this podcast, True Crime Cat Lawyer, with my co-host Winston, my cat. She is a mustache, bow-tied, fierce little ball of sass, and we both come to you every other Thursday telling some stories from our hometown of the Pacific Northwest. We try to cover cases from Oregon, Washington, Alaska. We're hoping to cover some from Canada soon. And we just like telling crime stories that are lesser known in the true crime community, but we do also cover some of the big ones. And if you are interested in learning more about our podcast, True Crime Cat Lawyer, you can head over to our website, truecrimecatlawyer.com. Or you can send us a quick email at truecrimecatlawyer@gmail.com. We're also on Instagram and Twitter, and we are available on pretty much every podcast platform that you will listen to. We hope you enjoy what you hear, and we hope you'll tune in. Thanks.